Hi, I'm Raf Grataro, and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, with a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days, 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it, you're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome back to the Breffni Early Show. I know it's been an absolute age since I've uploaded an episode to the podcast, and I suppose there's a good reason for that, is that I got distracted last year by getting involved with Sligo Rovers, and so it's quite fitting that when I'm bringing back the podcast for the first episode in about 18 months, that I am joined by an absolute legend of the club, albeit no longer a current player. We'll talk more about all of that later on. But Raf Grataro, Mr. Sligo Rovers, I suppose, effectively, even though you're currently playing a trade with Finn Harps, it's great to be here in Tubbercurry and great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. It's also unique in that it's the first time I've had a family member of a previous guest, because obviously we've had your cousin Carlo from a completely different world on the show as one of our early guests a couple of years back. How does that feel to be the secondary, for the first time probably in your life around here, to be like the lesser known Grataro?
Yeah, it's quite fitting, all right, as you says. And I had a little listen to the podcast, obviously, that yourself and Carlo done, so it was fantastic. Obviously, I'd known a lot of the stuff, but there was some stuff that I didn't know, and it was fantastic. It was really interesting.
Well, hopefully today we can do the exact same for people who think they know you. Maybe we can maybe just pare back that little shell a little bit and just kind of get a better glimpse into the world of Raf Grataro. We are, of course, sitting here in Tubbercurry, which is tubber, as in the Irish word for well, rather than an actual tub of curry. But let's talk about fast food for a moment while we're in Tubbercurry. What does fast food mean to you?
Well, obviously, that's what pretty much brought me here, brought my family here. Obviously, the fast food industry was what all the Italians were at back in the 70s. And Dad obviously came to Ireland with a couple of his peers and ended up settling here in Tubbercurry and has been here for now 40 years plus.
Was that a marketing gimmick at the time when he said, okay, I'm going to put a pin somewhere in Ireland? Was Tubbercurry, that's a great marketing ploy, I'll go there, or what else dragged him?
He's pretty much got a globe, span it around and stuck a pin in it and landed in Tubbercurry. In all fairness, I think it was a big thing, especially in his region, that, you know, Dublin was a go-to place. So there was a lot of emigration from his part of Italy, which is just south of Rome, about an hour south of Rome. And it's quite a poor enough area. A lot of them came over, they seen opportunity. Like I said, he worked for a while in Dublin with some of his peers and decided then, you know what, there's an opportunity here. Maybe go west, you know, where some of them had already been, and Tubbercurry is where he ended up. I do know that he was previously in Gurchin, so that's only 10 minutes away, but Tubbercurry is where he stayed.
I'm guessing the way your life has panned out with Real Tubber and Sligo Rovers and all the various places, you're quite happy with that move.
Absolutely. Look, been absolutely blessed, you know, and we were well thought of here, and, you know, Dad was obviously a foreigner and came into the town, and, you know, within a couple of years had made loads of friends and had met obviously my mother, who was from Ballina, and you know, like I said, the rest is history.
So talk to us about Real Tubber, because obviously that was your first introduction to football. How was football always a thing in your life, having an Italian heritage, where you kind of assumed that you were going to be the next one? That wasn't, would have been Paolo Maldini back then, but the next Dino Zoffer, whoever. Yeah, he wasn't the goalkeeper, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's always been a part of my life, but I think really when I really felt, right, Jesus, I love football, all of a sudden, Jesus, I'm not too bad at it. I think it was in 1990. We went to Italy at the time for the summer. We went
to... good year to be in Italy.
Absolutely, yeah. We went to the World Cup. So just everyone at that stage in Italy had a ball in their hand. Every child, nearly every adult. So it was crazy over there. So that summer, I can remember just been out kicking football all summer long, and it's fitting that you said Dino's off. One of our friends, basically, who lives across the road, his name is Dino, and me and him just every day, playing, kicking football, doing something. And I don't know, was it that I realised that I was good at it, or that maybe that people realised I was good at it. But we went anyways to the Ireland Italy match. I remember that year, and I remember the atmosphere. I remember being in, actually, we were in the Irish section actually. But I had a pair of shorts on me, denim shorts with an Irish flag painted on one of them and an Italian flag painted on the other leg. So it was an amazing atmosphere and something I'll never forget. I remember going obviously with Dad and my mum, and I was only 8 at the time, so I still actually remember it. And I think that's when I really said, I want to be a footballer, you know, Scalacci. Everyone was, you know, every time I scored a goal, it was, yay, Scalacci running away celebrating. So that'll tell you, that's the memories I have. And that's probably what really pushed me in terms of, yeah, I want to be a footballer.
It's mad to think that we're obviously more or less the same age. I think there's 4 or 5 months between us. We're both 81, as far as I'm aware.
That's yeah, age, yeah, yeah.
You had slightly longer football career than I did. Mine ended around 23, 24, just purely out of laziness. But you progressed right through the ranks. So obviously you joined Real Tubber here, the local club in Tubbercurry. Who were the main influences on you as you grew up in that? Would they have been your dad? Would they have been family members? Or would they have been from within the local community?
I think the local community. You know, obviously Dad was involved with Real Tubber at the time. As a player, and he did manage them once or twice as well over the years, the seniors. But, you know, there was never real any pressure. You know, Dad never was pushing me towards right football, Gaelic football, hurling, whatever. There was never any pressure put on me. I think it was just the community here, just down from where we are here, the square as we call it. There was a group of us, all the lads that lived in the town here. We'd go on the square, and from the minute we finished school, which is whatever, 3-4 o'clock, till 9-10 o'clock at night, where your mother's on the corner calling you to come in.
It's a different world now, isn't it?
And that's what we did. That's what we did all day, every day. That's football. And geez, Tony Burke down here, Joe Burke, should I say, his dad, Lord rest his soul, used to kill us because he had all cars there that he'd be fixing up. He was selling cars, obviously, the garage. We'd be kicking football beside them, and the odd one had hit it, and he'd come out and he'd run us, and sure, we'd be back 10 minutes later kicking it again. So that'll tell you, like, and how much it's changed now to where we're outside our front shop, the takeaway, obviously on the hill there, you know, the street, Humbert Street. And me and my two brothers, obviously we'd put Fabio and Goldman, the smallest, and myself and Maurizio go outfield, and we'd kick for 10 minutes outside on the main road, and a car wouldn't pass by. If you did that now, you'd be killed. Mm-hmm. So that's how much of a difference in terms of all the traffic that's on the road compared to back then, where you could go 10 minutes without a car passing. Right, you'd see the car at the top of the hill, you hold the ball in your hand. As soon as the car goes by, you're rolling it out to set yourself up for a shot. So that's where it is, and I think that's changed a lot.
Do you look back now and see, while all the... Obviously, the underage national leagues that have come on board, they're massive, and I know you've coached in those yourself. I haven't played in the kind of the precursors to that, I'm going to say, 18 or 20 years ago. Do you look now and see the street football that you played, and that is historically talked about as where the best players came from, the likes of Wes Hoogland playing and yourself playing street football? Do you look now with kind of any kind of regret about how players are formed now, and that the only time they kick a football nearly is at football training?
Yeah, I think that's the big thing, you know, to try and get the kids out playing on the street. You know, I say with my own son is only 3, and, you know, he knows how to work an iPad. So for me, that's a little bit alarming, you know, a little bit saying, right, if I see him, you know, he's no more than 20 minutes on an iPad, I have him off it. We're out on the trampoline kicking football, we're in the garden kicking football. And that's the way I want to bring my little lad up, where he's not in playing a PlayStation for 3-4 hours on end. You know, I want him to be out enjoying. I want him to be out climbing the tree in the garden and stuff like that. And I think maybe there's a little bit in us is that we're afraid to let our kids out in case, if he does climb the tree, what if he falls? You know, just let them out. Let them be kids. Let them fall, break an arm, you know, go to the hospital, get their cast on. Everybody signs it. All part of growing up. And I think that's a little bit with the street football. You know, it's very, very rarely I see kids now out with their jumpers down and going playing football, you know. Most of the estates I go into now have actually got a better setup. they've got the big steel goals in the middle of the green, two sets of them, and the kids will play. But, you know, any time I go into a state, it's very, very seldom I'd see them playing.
Let's go forward a couple of years. And obviously, you've played a couple of years with Real Tubber at this stage. You've gained some notoriety. How did you end up moving from Real Tubber into Sligo Rovers? And was that always the dream?
Yeah, I think it was the dream. Because I can remember going back as far as... I was under 16 at the time. Niall Harrison was the Sligo Leitrim under 18's manager, so I was still under 16 and had been playing. I was the captain of the Sligo Leitrim under 16, and Niall had seen me once or twice playing, and he had brought me in then with the 18's, playing with the 18's. He thought, right, he's decent, he could be a decent squad player or whatever he's seen in me, and he brought me in playing, obviously older, with the older lads. So that had probably brought me on even a lot more than, say, if I was staying in with the 16s and just plodding away and been decent. He's brought me into an environment where, right, I was fighting a little bit harder. And physically, I wasn't always the biggest, but I had that.
Really?
No, I had that.
That's dripping with sarcasm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's, I'm well used to it.
What height are you?
I'm actually 5'6".
Okay.
Yeah, I don't look it, but I actually am.
So, like, you're short by any stretch of the imagination, yeah. But yet it's never really held you back.
Never, never. That's one thing I'll always say. It's never held me back. I've always had that tenaciousness. You know, I get stuck in.
Does that come from being that basic child in a kind of an older teenager's team?
100%. That was the next thing I was going to say. When I was playing down on the square just down here, I wasn't playing with lads my own age. I was playing against lads that were 3 years older than me, 4 years older than me, some of them. So I was always playing with lads that were older than me, you know, a step ahead of me. So I always had to up my game. So that has definitely 100% had something to do with my development. You know, obviously physically I wasn't the strongest, but I always had that bite about me. It never stopped me challenging for stuff in the air, and you know, I think come now, if you ask anyone, is Rafferty any good in the air, they'll always say, he's not bad, is he?
Yeah, pretty much.
I've nailed it. Timing probably been the big one over the years. You know, if you time the header well, you can just get there and hang for that split second or two to get the head. But it's definitely had something to do with my development, you know. And as I said, and going back to being brought in by Niall Harrison into the under 18s and me still under 16, we went on to win the All-Ireland that year, and we were training in the showgrounds. So that was my first real, right, been in the Sligo Rovers dressing room, seeing all the boots along the underneath the where the lads had togged out in the dressing rooms, and the bench in the middle where the physio worked. And this is all new to me, and I was like, wow, this is. And we'd be going out then training, and the Sligo Rovers lads, they'd be training on the pitch beside us. So you were seeing all this, and you're like, that's what I want to do. That's what I want. That's where I want to go. I want to play there. Like, I want to be those lads. And surely enough, within 2 years, you know, I think we were slightly from under 18. I was at my age level at that stage, me and Michael McNamara. Again, we'd gotten to an All-Ireland final in the same competition. Unlucky to lose out to Wexford.
Kevin Doyle.
We lost out to them, and pretty much, I think it was Chris Rutherford and Tommy Cassidy. Chris Rutherford was in and around the club at the time, and Tommy Cassidy obviously was the manager. And they had invited me and Michael McNamara in for pre-season.
Okay, before we get into the playing with the senior team, can you talk about how it was a brand new experience for you, going into the inner workings of the dressing room and stuff? You weren't a stranger to the showgrounds, though.
No. I was no stranger to the showgrounds.
When did that start?
Jesus, that started when I was about 12. I can remember going in with Dad.
Do you remember your first game?
I think the first game I was at was the Bruges game. Because there was so much hype around it. It's like we were in Europe.
I think they lost playing, 3-2. Yes. I think, if memory serves.
Playing FC Bruges. I was up the end, obviously, where the bloody fence had been knocked and the lads all on top of it. Now, I wasn't in on top of it, as I was beside me dad. But I still remember. I still remember being in the terrace standing. You had the cop, obviously, always there. Now, I was a bit young to be in the cop, so I was kind of away from it. But, again, messing about and looking at the game, obviously, with friends and the lads. But that's my first memory of being actually in the showgrounds watching a game. And, you know, that's 94, like.
Let's go back to Michael McNamara that you mentioned, who played, which obviously went on to win a Connacht Championship, captain Sligo to a Connacht Championship in Gaelic football. Did you ever look at him and say, you know, because obviously Sligo Rovers hold a domination in the county, essentially. If most counties in rural Ireland, the GAA is first, and the soccer, if it exists, comes a distant second, I think it's fair to say. In Sligo, if it's not 50-50, it probably even weighs in favour of Rovers over the GAA in terms of profile, in terms of just conversation. Do you ever look at his career and say, maybe that was what I should have done, or is there ever any kind of discussion about that at all?
Nah. I couldn't, like, I can remember Michael McNamara, you know, been such a good defender, you know, playing out from the back, just an all-nonsense defender, you know, he defended first and foremost, but when it was on to play, he'd play, and he'd gotten, you know, a lot of recognition, and he was captain then, like, he was 22, 23, as I said, he was captain of the club, and he was a leader, and within a year then, possibly 2 years, he had left the club to go and play Gaelic football. But that was a choice he wanted. And I know Michael's his background is GAA in general. But, you know, in my instance, it was soccer. Like I said, there was never any pressure put on me to choose anything. You know, if there was a Gaelic football match and a soccer match on the same day, if I could play the two of them, I would. But if I had to choose one, it would have most likely been the soccer I would have chose because I was better at it. I think that was the main thing. I found it a more level playing.
Difficult to be decent 5'6" when you're playing football.
Thanks very much. And I thought it was more of a level playing field for me, playing soccer on the ground, the physicality of it and everything else. It was a more level playing field with the soccer, and the fact that I was probably better at it had something to do with it. But yeah, look, it was never a case for me where I needed to, you know, soccer was me and I was never going to choose anything else. I loved playing it, I loved being involved in it. Obviously, I was a fan before I went into the showgrounds, so, you know, there was all positives growing up before I actually went into that environment.
Let's get back to Chris Rutherford and Tommy Cassidy, where he had started talking before I took a bit of a tangent. They invited you in. Yourself and Michael came into the showgrounds together with the first team. What was it like the first day you walked in? You knew the environment from the underage, you'd seen the dressing room. What was it like actually being part of that dressing room for the first time?
It was funny because I remember the very first session, and I think I've told this story I think a few times. The very first session we met at the Sligo Racecourse. So that's where the horses go, like. So This was the training methods back then, obviously, you know,
We're talking about what, 99,
98? You're talking about 2000.
Okay. Yeah.
So these were the training methods back then, obviously. So we've came in, didn't know what to expect, to be honest. The one thing I did know is that there was going to be no balls anyways. We're in a race course. So I've come in and I said, right, I need to get my bearings together. There's going to be a difficult session here at hand. So obviously myself, Michael McNamara was an athlete anyways, you know, never struggled with the running part of the game, never. But obviously I was built different. Michael was built for doing the long distance, the stamina stuff, whereas I was built for the short, sharp stuff. So anytime there was long stuff, I'm always at the back, dragging myself along with a parachute, pretty much. But Never once did I quit. Always did it. Never once, you know, as tough as it was. And that first session where I was like, OMG, this is what it's like. You know, I was prepared to do it. I wanted to do it, you know. There was no stopping me. Whatever was getting in my way, I was overcoming it, you know. And that was only the first of a season where we were, as Tommy Cassidy used to say, one of his sayings was, let's get fit. That was one of his sayings, you know, and I'll be forever grateful for him, you know, for bringing me in, obviously, and giving me my chance, and giving me my debut, obviously, for Sligo Rovers. But, you know, it was different, and the environment then, obviously, within 2 weeks, the ball started to come out, And obviously, I was never in an environment where the kind of sessions that they were doing in there. And again, I'm a young 18 year old in playing with the likes of Steve Burks, Ian Gilzean, who was in there that year, and Pádraic Moran, who a player that I was looking at saying I wanted to be, you know, who was obviously the main man of Sligo Rovers, scoring all the goals. And you know, I have to say, when I came in, the likes of him, Ian Gilzean, they were unbelievable to me. They made me feel so welcome. Anything that I struggled with, they'd help me with. You know, they went out of their way to try and help me, which was fantastic. And it's something that I always said to myself that I'd do if there was any young lads come in, that I'd do my best to help them, you know, make it easy for them, the transition coming into the senior dressing room. For whatever reason, you know, whether it be mentally or physically, that I'd help them. And like, it was done to me, and it helped me, you know, massively.
The first couple of years in Sligo wouldn't have been filled with success. Even the first decade, it was the first division title, I think, in 2005. But it was pretty lean years. Not all that unusual for Sligo, maybe with the exception of this decade, where there's been unmitigated success for the first 4 or 5 years of this decade. But the noughties, and you spent virtually every year there. I think you'd one little sojourn at Galway that we're going to talk about. But what was it like when you know you're struggling to get results, to win stuff, to kind of just, I suppose, be there but not really there, if that makes sense? That must be difficult. Or was it?
I don't think it was difficult, to be honest with you. Because I always had in my head that I was going to win stuff, you know. Obviously, you have to go through the hard times to get you to the better times. And I think that was always in the back of my head, in terms of, you know, you're going to have to slog it out here, you know. We will get out of the first division, you know. That was in the back of my head, you know. Obviously, there was 4 years, 5 years there where we were slogging. We were in touching distance, been mid-table, been in maybe the top three, top two. To when Sean Connor then came in 2005... and pretty much put everybody full time, and we went and pretty much steamrolled the whole league and won it with two games to go against Kilkenny in the Showground. So I knew that day was
second that year.
Yeah, exactly. So
Dublin City, who I was involved with.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
they did.
We did beat Shamrock Rovers in the playoff and went up with you. But I was delighted, even though I was involved with Dublin City at the time, I was delighted that Sligo Rovers were the team that pipped us. Do you know what I mean? Because obviously, having grown up in the Showgrounds, yeah, it was cool. So yeah, Sean Connor, obviously, big impact on you anyway.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he came in and he changed everything, you know. He came in, he gave his pitch where he wanted to go all full time, and the club bought into it, you know. The players bought into it, to what he was doing. I think that season we were struggling. Ian Rossiter was there, if I'm correct, he was still there, who had gotten injured, and I ended up playing the full season at right back. And I remember Liam Burns was on the right side of centre half, and I played right back. And it was probably the first time I'd played right back. You know, maybe once or twice I'd played there. But he made it so easy for me. You know, obviously he was an old head. You know, he was 27, 28 at that stage. I was, 2005, you're talking about 23 possibly. You know, so I was still relatively young, you know, and he just made it so easy, and I ended up getting Player of the Year that year from playing right back. Scored something like 8 goals, so you know, a great return from right back. And you know, obviously we went and we won the first division and got promoted, and I thought I had a fantastic season. And at the end of that season, then obviously me and Sean were trying to sort something out. And unfortunately, probably because I got bad advice, I ended up moving to Galway United, and signing with them, you know. And you know, probably something, you know, because Sean was good. He was good to me, and you know, he knew, you know. And I know now that the contract that he had offered me was a good contract. But obviously, the advice I was getting wasn't the right advice. I know that now.
Do you regret that?
I won't say I regret it, because it brought me down to Galway. It opened my eyes up in regards, right, different surroundings, different people. I went down to Galway that year. We're in the first division again. Had a fantastic season down there. Got into team of the year. Played, you know, scored 10 plus goals. Had a good season. We got promoted that year as well. And, you know, I had a great season. So I didn't see it as a negative. Would I have liked to have played, especially in the Premier Division with Sligo? Absolutely, 100%. And when the chance arose then in 2007 to come back, I just jumped at it, you know.
I mean, I want to talk a little bit more about why you left, because it's happened 3 times in your career that you've left Sligo. Obviously, you are known locally as Mr. Sligo Rovers, and people talk about Sligo Rovers, and you're the first name off most people's out of most people's mouths. But you have made that decision to leave 3 times: 2006 Galway, 2010 Bohemians, and now this season to go to Finn Harps for arguably your swan song. Let's be honest, 38. There's not many players who even got to that level.
Yeah.
Never mind hitting 40. What was the motivation behind you? You mentioned bad advice, but what was actually the deciding factor in that decision? Was it was there a personality clash? Was there financial issues, or why would you decide, if you're happy in Sligo, to leave? Because obviously there's people going through that at the moment. Not necessarily at the moment, but every year you look at, even just taken locally from a Sligo point of view, the likes of Gary Boylan and choosing to go to Cork, who are not doing very well in the league, which is people could kind of foresee. With all due respect, yourself at Finn Harps, struggling at the bottom of the table, although probably in a false enough position based on where you've been. You've been very unlucky in games. What can you give to somebody else who might be in that situation, maybe a player in their early 20s, in a really good situation? Probably the best thing for them to do would be to stay where they are, but something turns their eye. What was it that caught your eye and made you want to leave?
I won't say it was something that caught my eye and made me want to leave. It was more of a decision. I think 2006, like I said, was probably, you know, bad advice. 2009 or 10, should I say, when I went to Bowes, I think I was been offered a 52-week contract, a 2-year deal. Financially, you know, I'm not ashamed
to
say.
There's actually no shame in that,
you know, I'm not ashamed to say financially it was rewarding. And obviously, Bowes were the kingpins of Irish football at the time, so that attracted, you know, that attraction there of possibly winning a league title, which we lost out by 2 goals, obviously, that year. So they were the deciding factors in 2009, you know. Look, Sligo weren't in a position to offer me a 52-week contract on whatever amount, you know.
Yeah.
It just wasn't feasible, you know. Mm-hmm. There was no player on the books that was probably on that barbaco. So, you know, it was just one of them decisions.
Well, I think that's the reality of football, is that people do essentially have to follow the money, because it's a short career. It could be ended by injury tomorrow, and you have to put yourself and your family and your finances in a position where I don't think anyone's going to have a problem with hearing that on the show. You came back from Bohemians in 2010. Now, Sligo Rovers had a particularly good season in 2010. They won the FAI Cup. How much did you, because I'm sure you watched the game, were you in the stadium?
I wasn't in the Aviva, no, but I watched it, yeah.
Yeah, so you'd played in the cup final the year before against Sport and Fingal and lost. Well, I don't know actually if you'd played in that game, did you?
Yeah, played, and I came off with a back injury. 75 minutes, we were 1-0 up at that stage and ended up losing late in the game, 2-1. So, yeah, it was disappointing to kind of go out in that. I would have loved to have went out, you know, winning the cup, but look, I'm a massive believer in these things happen for a reason, and
that's what I was going to come to. And so 2009 cup final disappointment, 2010 you've gone to Bohemians to win trophies, and Sligo Rovers end up winning the FAI Cup. There has to be a little bit of a kind of a karma kind of giving you a little kick going, you shouldn't have left in that. What were your feelings on that day in 2010 in the cup final, looking at the lads you'd played with the previous year, or at least some of the lads you'd played with the previous year, lifting the trophy. Was there any kind of regret or?
I won't say regret because I don't. There's not too much I regret. You know, if anything, like I said, all these things happen for a reason. But there was, I was delighted. I was delighted that the club obviously had won an FAI Cup, the first in since what
1994.
Yeah. So that, you know, I was delighted for that. Disappointed that we had lost it ourselves the previous year, and you know, I think all throughout that year, obviously, I went to Bowes, you know. And, you know, my big message probably would be to any player now, you know, the grass isn't always greener on the other side. It isn't, genuinely. If you're in an environment that you were happy in, regardless money, everything like that, you know, and you're thriving in that environment, stay in it. Why take yourself out of it? You know, stay in that environment. And that was me. Sligo was my club. Sligo was where I played my best football. Sligo was home. And I think I realised that in 2009 when I left, because I was at Bowes maybe 3-4 months. I was a little bit homesick, even though I'm only 2 hours up the road. I was a little bit homesick, obviously.
You wouldn't want the cops hear you saying you're 2 hours up the road in Dublin, because it'd take me 2.5 picking up speeding tickets from Mullingar.
We were living in Blanche, so it was a little bit closer, so I'll say that it wasn't that close.
Speed limit issues.
That's obviously that'd be my message to any lad, like, but like I couldn't make any other decision than that decision that I had made, because like I said, I was getting a 52-week contract. I had never gotten a 52-week contract.
They're very rare in the league.
Absolutely. I was on a 40-week contract always. So for a 40-week, 42-week possibly, and then for the other 10 weeks, I had to sign on the dole. So I was, you know, I was saying, right, geez, I've 52-week contract. I don't have to worry about ending for 2 years. You know, I have a 52-week contract there. I can go now, I can really concentrate on the football part of things. But again, like I said, I was thriving in that environment that I was in, and I took myself out of it, you know, I won't say to go for money, because it wasn't really money.
It was the whole opportunity, I suppose.
Opportunity, really, to go and win trophies, you know, that was the big thing. Was, if we had the benefit of hindsight, I didn't know that Bowes were going to go pretty much bankrupt the following season. You know, I had no recollection. I didn't have any foreseeable. I don't think anyone could have, bar the people that were involved in the club. Mm. You know, players definitely didn't know anything about it. But like I said, it was a case, go up there, see how I get on. And like I said, Paul Cook that year would have kept in contact with me all the time. You know, an odd text here, an odd text there.
It's probably just a best luck or well done, but he's really kind of saying, don't forget about us.
Pretty much. And I remember then, in, obviously, it had been documented come July that financially Bowes were in a little bit of trouble. And I remember Porrick Amond was with Sligo at the time, but he was on the way out to some Portuguese team. Yeah. So Paul Cook was just onto me, flat out, right, we gotta get this done, you know, I want you to come back, I want, you know, obviously they're financially in trouble, you know, we'll take you on here, and, you know, we'll make things work. Now I would have to take in a big drop in wages, but that didn't bother me. That was the last thing on my mind. Is I wanted to get back, I wanted to play for the manager that I probably played my best football under. You know, and I wanted to make it happen, but for some reason, or for whatever reason, look, Pat Finlan was reluctant to let me go. Whether he seen obviously something in me that he thought would help, you know, go win the league. And I think I finished off very strong actually that season. I think probably the reason why I finished so strong was because I felt like I was wanted, and Paul Cook again, unknowingly, probably had a bit of influence in that, because he made me feel I was wanted by another manager, even though I hadn't, you know, I had scored a couple of goals that year, but I had picked up an injury compartment syndrome that kept me out for like 10 to 12 weeks. So I'd missed a part of the season. But I went and I scored 10 goals again for been out for 12 weeks of the season and go and score 10 goals. And most of them been in the second half of the season where we were pushing to go and win the league. And I remember playing St. Pat's, third last game of the season. And we were playing Pat's in Richmond Park. And we got a penalty, Killian Brennan. I remember stepping up, he took the pen, the keeper saved it, and I ran in and I slotted the rebound in. We won that game 1-0. I scored the rebound. We'd then taken over Shamrock Rovers. Then we'd went 3 points clear of Shamrock Rovers at that stage with two games remaining.
It's not a bad spot to be in.
Not a bad spot to be in, two games left. Our next game, away to Galway United, who had already been relegated in Turryland Park the following week. So all we needed was a point. We ended up going losing the game 3-2. And the final game of the season, then we went and we beat Dundalk. I think it was 4-1, something like that. And just wasn't enough. They ended up beating us by two goals for the league title. So yeah, if we'd gotten that result we needed, obviously against Galway United, who were already relegated, and that can have a thing in your head where you're going into the game, yeah, these lads are already relegated, you know, maybe this might be possibly just all we have to do is show up. But Galway United were pretty much had beaten us three times that season, so they were already relegated, but didn't stop them. They went hell for leather because we were Bows and we were the squad to beat. Everyone raised their game 20% every time we played them, and that was a big eye opener for me that year, that every no matter what team you played, whether it was the bottom or the top team, they always upped their game 15% or 20% to play against you. And I think that later had a massive influence in me when we went for our league title with Sligo in 2012. I knew that every team we were going to play against, you had to be at the top of your game. There was no off days. You couldn't have an off day, because if you had an off day, you were going to get punished for it. And that, for me, was a massive learning curve that year that I brought with me to 2012 and helped go and win a league title at my hometown club, Sligo.
Before we talk about the league title, we're going to get onto it very quickly. I want to talk about the cup finals, because obviously the cup would have played a huge role in that success, 2011, 2013 as well. And you lost the final in 09, missed out in the final in 10 when you were Bows. 2011, talk me through that final from your own personal point of view.
Again, like 2011 is probably a season I couldn't have dreamt of, to be honest with you, because I've came back, obviously. We've had a fantastic season in the league. We were in the top two. We finished second that year. I think not a point or two, I think, off. Was it Pats or?
Rovers,
yeah. Sorry. So
Shams, should I say?
Yeah, Shams. Yeah,
Shams. I'm in Sligo. I never say Shams.
And so, you know, everything was on the up. Obviously, the cup was won the previous year, the two cups, the League Cup and the FAI Cup. So we were riding the crest of a wave at that stage. And it came again where we're November has come, you know, where we find ourselves in the Aviva for a second year in a row, and a cup final 3 years in a row. And you're like, I can't believe I'm getting the opportunity again to go and do this. And now, I didn't start the game, and we played a tricky Shelburne team that year, who probably did well on the day. Did we play as well as we could have? Probably not on the day, but we passed the ball really, really well. But they
so
were.
The cup final shells of the player sent off very early in the game.
Yeah. But they were very well organised. Alan Matthews was the manager. And, you know, he had them very well organised. You know, they sat back, they tried to catch it on the counter attack. And, you know, we had massive, you know, possession. I think it could have been 70-30. You know, we had large parts of the ball. And we moved the ball quite well. But they crowded the area most that you wanted to get in was the box. And, you know, they made it as difficult as possible for us. Now, this is funny that we're here talking about it, because I only watched the game, the highlights of the game over again there about a week ago. Just, you know, I like to go over them, and that we had a lot of opportunity to win that game. You know, we had I remember John Dillon going down the line to the end line and pulling a ball back for Owen Doyle, and the ball getting stuck under his foot, you know, like 4 yards out, pretty much. And Owen Doyle, who was on absolute fire that year, you couldn't have asked it to fall to anybody else. And it just felt like, oh, is it going to happen? And then, of course, Davo pops up out of nowhere with well, we think it was a cross, but he'll say it was a shot. Yeah.
I've spoken to Ireland about this.
Yeah. He says it's a shot, but we all think it was a cross because...
He shot in his life.
Pretty much, yeah. He's never shot in his life.
He's left back for a reason.
Yeah. So, yeah, but Jesus, it couldn't have came at a better time. And, you know, that brought it into extra time then. I think I came on for the last 10 minutes of normal time and played all the extra time. And it was just fitting then that it worked out where I was the final spot kick taker to win it.
It goes to penalties. Was that in the back of your mind when you went, oh, I'll go last? Or how did that work out?
I think Cookie says, look, give me five lads is going to take. I says, look, I'll be fifth. And there was no thing in it where, oh, maybe I'll get the chance. It was, I was hoping we'd have won it well by then, that they'd have, you know, they wouldn't come to me even taking it, you know.
So you're volunteering, but kind of hoping against hope it's not going to be.
Because I remember that year, we got a penalty that year in 2011. And we missed the penalty. I don't know who took it. I'm trying to think who took it. Someone took it anyways. And I remember Paul Cook going through me for a short cut. For not stepping up. He says, you're a striker. You're confident. He says, you should be grabbing that ball and going and taking that penalty. And I'd be kind of a lad that'll say, right, I know my strength, you know. And look, penalties is something I think you need to work at, as is free kicks. You know, I'll never profess to be a free kick taker because I don't put the hours in. You got to stay half an hour, 40 minutes, possibly an hour every day, just whacking balls every day to be a free kick taker. It's all practice. And I didn't do the practice, you know. But then you have the lads, the likes of Richie Ryan, who has naturally a cultured left foot that could bend something into the top corner without even doing it once in training, you know. And that was it. But for me, I'd have to work at it. And penalties was one of those things that you had to stay back, take 10, 15 penalties, head off in down the dressing room. And as my career went on, I started to do that, you know, after Paul Cook had said it to me. And I pretty much still do it now to this day. But I don't think I've gotten a penalty since.
Well, there might be a message in that too.
Yeah, there's a message in that, absolutely.
But there's a nice kind of romanticism about a cup final, your local team, local boy, you've come back after a couple of dalliances in other places, you've come back, you're the prodigal son, and you're stepping up in the Aviva with the match win and penalty. Now, obviously, we can't forget about Kieran Kelly, who played heroics that day and the previous year.
Obviously, I think we all knew that Tracky, as we call him, Kieran Kelly, was going to come on.
I think the whole crowd did as well. The whole crowd were kind of qualified.
I think mentally, you're getting in, obviously, the other player's head that this fella has saved four penalties the previous year. It's something, it's a mental thing. And sure, look, it proved that it was the right decision by Paul to bring him on. And he saved, was it three out of the... He saved three, I think, if not four, again. Like you said, it comes to me then. And all I'm thinking is, right, hit the target, you know. If the keeper makes a good save, that's it. It's a lottery penalties. Just once you hit the target, you know, you've done your bit then. And the one thing I did take into consideration, I looked at the four previous penalties to me that were hit. And I looked at the keeper always went the side. So if I was a right footer, the keeper would always go to his right. So he's standing the goals, he'd go to his right. He always dived as if you were going to whip it.
Yeah.
And when the left footers, he dived to the left for Richie Ryan. So he always picked that side. That was the four. So I says, right, he's going to think I'm going to whip it. And I just went up with kind of a body shape to whip it to the corner and just slotted it then down the left side. Obviously he went the wrong way, and look, all I can remember then is just running off, taking me top off, swinging it around the back of the goal, and just going on then to celebrate for a couple of days, you know. But I couldn't have dreamt, you know, personally I couldn't have dreamt of a better way to come back. And you know, I'd lost, obviously in 2009 I'd lost the cup final, and the way I did, obviously coming off injured, going off, we were 1-0 up and end up losing it. But to come back then and to do it in the Aviva, and probably the way we'd done it, you know, for me, just personally for me, it was a thank you. It was like, thank you Lord for giving me this opportunity and giving me the chance to win an FAI Cup, something that I wanted to do obviously all my career since I started playing. But after that then, you know, like the rest is history.
Well, you've
like,
already mentioned 2012 winning the title, and let's go forward. The title year is kind of, it's obviously you were the best team in the country, you dominated the league the whole way through the year. You've come in as FAI Cup winners, you've got European football, you've got the Stanley Cup that's going on as well. And let's talk about the run-in. Three games left. You need, I think, to win two of them or just beat Pats, who are getting closer and closer in the league title race. And that brings us to the third last game of the season against St. Pat's in the Showgrounds. Capacity crowd. They've brought in temporary seating to accommodate everybody. And probably 6,000 people in the Showgrounds. Probably hasn't been as full since or before. And you're starting, and things, again, couldn't have really gone any better for you. You mentioned your prowess in the air. I'm not sure it's one of your better headers, but it's definitely one of your more important ones. You scored two goals that day. One absolute belter, and then the header to put them two up. Again, let's talk through that day as well. How big of an event was that? Does it eclipse the cup final?
Nah, for me, that day just stands out. Above anything else in my career, I think that day will always just be in my head as being the best day I've ever had with the club. And not, you know, not just because I scored two goals. I think just because I'm just after doing something that I've always wanted to do with my hometown club. You know, obviously, like you said, capacity crowd. I just happened to be one of the lads that scored that day. You know, Do you run scenarios like that in your head before you go out to play? Me personally, I do. I always run a scenario right. If this happens, am I going to be, you know, am I in a situation to score in a certain part of the pitch? If I get into that part of the pitch, can I do this to try and score?
So you'd visualize that.
Visualize, absolute visualization before every match. You know, you'll run it through your head. I kept running it through my head, not just before the game, but, you know, the week leading up to it. And that wasn't me thinking I was starting. That was me just, if I was starting, this is what I was visualising. And I think the first goal that I got was something I had actually visualised happening, getting the ball at the edge of the box and beating a man and slotting it. And the way it happened, it was quality the way it happened. It was decent, but I visualized it in a little lesser capacity, you know. And you know, it's funny that I do that, because after that we you know, we'd have sports psychologists coming in, and visualization would be a massive thing that they would you know, get us to do. But I had already been doing it before they had ever came in, and I think it had been a massive thing for me, you know, going forward in my career. Obviously thinking of positively and self-talk, you know, positive talk to yourself within the game, been a big thing, you know. And I think the more I think about it now and the more I look into it, it is a massive part of the game. But that day, like I said, you know, I was just delighted for everyone that was involved in the club, more importantly the fans, because they had waited what, 34 years, 35 years for the first title to come to the Northwest, you know. So I think that it'll definitely be always the main, you know, standout point in my career. And I think a lot of the fans would probably say the same thing, you know, because just the whole setting of the day, the lovely day that was in it, the way the ground looked with the four, you know, the four seating areas all around it closed in, and just the day it was for a game of football, and the game it was, the way it ended, Mark Quigley scoring the winner, you know, late drama, as they do say.
Well, let's talk about that, because were you on the pitch at the time?
I was.
So you talked about giving out to Frashirk in the penalty previously. You're on two goals, you're in your home ground, home team, winning the league, penalty, last couple of minutes of the game. Was there a thought in your head to say, I want him on this?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think what I was looking at the bigger picture. I was looking at the bigger picture, and if there was anyone I would pick in a situation like that, it would be Merrick. So I was never in any doubt that he was going to miss. You couldn't ask for a more cooler person to be in that situation than him. So that was the bigger picture. I wanted a league title. It wasn't about me going, scoring three goals, scoring a hat-trick, first hat-trick or whatever. Didn't even cross my mind.
Would that have been your first hat-trick?
That would have been my first. I have never scored a hat-trick, believe it or not. Yeah, in League of Ireland football. Wow. Yeah, never. I've scored plenty of doubles, but never a hat-trick. But yeah, you couldn't have asked for a more cooler man in that situation. He was that cool now. If he was any more relaxed, he'd fall over. Do you know? That's the kind of lad he was. And it was made for him, and I was delighted for him, because he had had a difficult start to that season. You know, he was a little bit homesick like I was when I was at Bowes. And I think it was documented a little bit halfway through the season that he wanted to move. I think Shamrock Rovers were on the cards or whatever it was. And Danny North then had got injured in the European game. And I think it was probably, for Mark anyways, it wasn't for us as a team, it wasn't great, because Danny North was scoring left, right and centre and was on absolute fire at the time. But when Danny North went, it just gave Mark Quigley the platform to step up to the plate, and he was just phenomenal. For the second part of the season, he was fantastic, you know. Just stood up to the occasion every time, you know, we needed something, he produced. Again, like I said, it couldn't have been a more fitting man to hit that penalty than him.
Yeah, well, it was a phenomenal year, and one that I'm sure that fans of the Bitter Red are never going to forget, because it was just amazing. 2013 comes another cup final. 2014 was the Setanta Cup. All the while, there's European adventures here, there, and everywhere over that period of time. But I want to talk about, because we've only really got a short time left, but I want to talk a bit more about the last couple of years, because it's been a very different kettle of fish in Sligo since 2014, since 2015, because it was a major trophy every year for 5 years, which, as much as Sligo Rovers fans might think that's kind of normal, in the history of the club, that's anything but normal. It's very much a peak. And the last couple of years, while not exactly at a trough level in terms of the club, they're still reasonably competitive. They beat Dundalk this year, they beat Shamrock Rovers this year, they beat Cork last year. You scored the winner down in Turner's Cross. So they can still go out and mix it with anybody in the league on any given day, but it has been a marked fall from the top two or three teams in the league to maybe in that relegation mix-up. So up to last season, when you were still at the club, how different was it to go from going out expecting to win every week to, like, we've got a chance here? Like, because it is a very different experience playing in that.
It is, yeah. Obviously, you know, that was the golden era of the club's history, you know, and will be marked down as probably the most successful part of the club's history, you know. For that to happen again, there is a likelihood that it will happen again, absolutely, especially in this league, because it tends to go around in circles anyways. And, you know, we had a 4-5 year period there where we were the kingpins of Irish football, pretty much. I think it came to a part, you know, of where financially it wasn't feasible anymore. Like, I don't know the ins and outs of it. I don't profess to know of it. You know, I think it's, you know, documented, you know, how much it is to run a club, obviously, within the league. But, you know, I think I'm sure that that's the reasons why. But I think the big thing over the successful period that we had was the development of the ground. Like, you know, during that period, you just look at what was done in that period around the showground. Like, you walk into the showgrounds now, it's the best. It's without a doubt. There's no debate here. It's the best ground in the country. You know, Cork, possibly a very very close second. Definitely a close second. The reason why I'd say the Showgrounds is the best ground because they have everything on site. You have a full size Astro right beside it.
I think Shamrock Rovers might argue as well, but then they don't own their grounds.
That's my next thing. Yeah. They don't own the ground. It's council owned. Am I right?
Yeah,
council owned. But now I do know Shamrock Rovers now have a fantastic training facility, Roadstone, which I visited obviously on my A license.
But again, not without its problems in that you have to go through a function centre to get out the back. You wouldn't know it's there unless you knew it was there.
I was thought I was walking into a golf club.
Yeah.
Pretty
well,
much.
It is a pitch of
yeah.
Club.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I thought I was walking into. And obviously you walk out the back of it and you see all these pitches, full size Astro, you know, all this stuff been done, you know, it's fantastic. But
you're right, the Showgrounds
is without a doubt. Look, it's fantastic. You know, is there room for improvement? Undoubtedly there is, 100%. You can always improve facilities, you know, for the players, without a doubt. But again, it costs money, you know. To get a sprinkler system, which is probably one of the big things. If I go back over my time at the club, is we were trying to play a brand of football in the Showgrounds that the pitch didn't allow us to play. Because we didn't get the pitch watered before the game, there was no sprinkler system, obviously. There was a method where we used to put on a thing where a man had to man it and pull it around the pitch, but by the time he has done the bottom part of it and he's up at the top pit, the bottom part is dry. So, you know, they're small things, but when you get to this level, they're a big thing, especially if you're trying to play a brand of football that we're used to, say, in the Showgrounds. And for me, that was probably, if I won the lotto, would be something I'd say to the club, here, go get the sprinkler system, go, you know, get that sorted. The pitch will always have grass on it then, because it'll have the sprinkler system, whatever else, there'll be no patches. The pitch will be phenomenal. And it is phenomenal. You see what the lads do with the pitch, and it was always fantastic down there. But if you're trying to play a brand of football and the pitch is bone dry, you can't move the ball as fast as you want to on it. And that's a small thing, but a relatively big thing when it comes, you know, to playing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But look,
they are actually, I was there last night for an under 17 game, and as we're recording this Thursday morning, and they've actually ripped out half of the main stand, and they're replacing the seats in the main stand. So there's 1,000 new seats going in. So it's great to see clubs actually put money into infrastructure. But let's talk about finances for a second, because it's been all over the news for the last 2 or 3 months about what's been happening in the FAI, where money has or hasn't been going. You mentioned earlier about 42-week contracts, 40-week contracts, having to sign on the dole. And whether we want it or not, there is a stigma with that. There is a stigma of rocking up to the local dole office to sign on, and whether you want to or not, or can afford to or not, people do slightly have an opinion they'd rather not be doing that. What's going through your mind as a professional League of Ireland player, seeing where money has been going from the FAI, while you're thinking, well, come October, I'm out of a job?
Yeah, well, obviously, the way I see it is, the weekend, I'm in the Aviva and I'm lifting the FAI Cup with Sligo Rovers. That following Monday, I'm walking into my local dole office applying for job seekers because my contract has now ended, and I need assistance, obviously, to pay bills, a mortgage, car loans, or whatever it may be. It's not this rock and roll lifestyle, as they say, you know, you're a footballer. You're a League of Ireland footballer. You know, at the end of your contract, I would say 90% of the current players go to the dole office to collect the dole. Now, the other, there might be 20% of that are part-time and are working already, and then the rest of them will be full-time players that don't have 52-week contracts. So it's difficult. It is, absolutely. It can be difficult for those 10 weeks, but if you're anyway, if you're any way clued in, you're obviously going to work things so that you can survive over them 10 weeks and pay your mortgage and everything else throughout the season.
Would you rather, say, let's for argument's sake, say someone was, now this is a very high wage, but say for ease of numbers, that somebody's on €1,000 a week for 42 weeks. So over the year they make 42,000. Would you rather be on an €800 a week contract for the longer period or be able to sign onto the door?
I would rather be on having that stable income for the
Exact same amount of money just spread over 52 weeks.
100%.
And would that be the norm within the league, within most players in the league? Would they prefer to have that kind of stability week on week?
100%. Like, say, we had a thing to sign for the PFAI, basically a questionnaire asking us, giving us multiple choice of, as a player, would you rather bigger wages or would you rather to be paid for 52 weeks and longer contracts, you know, over a 52-week, maybe lesser money over a 52-week period? That was the question. Every single player ticked it. Every player wants to be paid for the 52 weeks of the year. And, you know, having that stability, you know, just yeah, that.
So the 1st of January is, yeah, your contract is 1st of January, 31st of December, whether you finish the league in October.
Absolutely.
Or
absolutely.
September is in the first division.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the big thing. And there's a lot of movement within the league. You know, everyone knows
every season
there's players moving left, right, centre. That has changed a little bit because I think what I have noticed is that clubs are giving longer contracts. Clubs are now looking at giving 2-year contracts, minimal 2-year contracts, because I think it's only right that you give 2-year contracts. Obviously, if you're trying to build something at a club, you want to keep your better players there. You know, if they're on 1-year contracts, if he has a good season, he's gone the next season because Shamrock Rovers, Dundalk can offer him twice as much as what you're going to offer him. Do you know? And that's the reality of it in this league. But I think managers and clubs now are starting to realise we need to get longer contracts. We need to give players longer contracts. They need to be a little bit more tight in the wording of the contract, as we know with Rhys McCabe and Mikey Drenahan. Leaving for Pats now. I don't know is if that's what happened, but I'm just going on what has been said. So maybe it did, maybe
let's
it
not
didn't.
Get into that.
I won't get into it. Okay, I don't know. Anyways, and I don't want to know. But like I said, it is changing. You know, it is changing for the better. I really do think it is. I think the league is getting a lot younger. You see the likes of Bowes, who have a very young squad.
One player over 22 the other night in a league game.
In a league game, yeah. And they're up around the top 2-3. So it can be done. It can be done. You know, does your recruitment have to be very good? Absolutely. You know, if your recruitment is good, obviously Keith Long has someone there in the background, you know, that's top-notch bringing, because it's not just a coincidence.
The last
2-3 years... He has brought players in.
You don't lose Shane Supple and replace him with James Talbot, but by accident.
Accident, absolutely. Yeah. He has someone that's doing, obviously, the recruiting for him, and they're top class.
Well, I've heard his little black book is worth having, so I think he's probably on top of that himself.
Absolutely, and credit to him. Yeah. All credit to him. He's doing a fantastic job there, you know. But it's great to see that there's trust now in the younger players coming into the league. Obviously, I'm in the later part of my career.
I'm sarcastic about your height there.
I even see in our own dressing room, you know, you have young lads like Sam Todd, Michael Gallagher. I could name the whole, you know, Stephen Doherty. These are all young lads, you know, that have just came for the 19s who are playing with the 19s still. Liam Kerrigan, obviously, with Sligo. Niall Moran, your native. You know, it's great to see it. You know, that these young lads are going out, are doing well, and that managers are putting trust in them, you know. And I think that's probably the way the league needs to go, because you see now with Jack Byrne at Shamrock Rovers, 500,000 price tag on his head, looking that he's going to Brentford. They had previously sold the keeper, the young lad, the 16-year-old, for Bazuna for 350,000.
I think it was closer to half a million.
Yeah, so
Ben Burke went for 350,000.
That's what I'm saying.
So over like, 1.3 million in,
they've brought in 1.3 million within 18 months.
Less 12 months.
Yeah, so you know, there's money to be made, you know, and I think if these young lads are playing international, you know, with the 21s, and are doing it with their clubs as well, you know, there's a chance that a team will take a chance of them in England and pay good money for them. So I think clubs are starting to realise that, and you know, Shamrock Rovers seem to be leading the way.
I think
that.
Some clubs are starting to realise that. I don't think all the clubs are quite on the same page yet. Let's talk about Fintan Harps, because we've talked a lot about Sligo Rovers, and you're not actually a Sligo Rovers player anymore.
Yeah.
You made the decision. I think you made the decision over the winter that you'd had a really good inning, 17 seasons in the Bitter Red, and. Can you tell us why? What was going through your mind at the time? Obviously, you'd gone to Galway, you'd gone to Bowes. You're local. You're 37. 38. Do you really need the hassle of going, playing another year? Like, why leave Sligo?
It's a tough one. Look, I would have loved to have stayed. I'd be honest with you. For me, I would have loved to have finished my career at the club. You know, I think everyone would know that I would have loved to have finished my career with the club that I started with. That wasn't to be for another, for whatever reason. It wasn't to be. But then I had spoken to Ollie, and have spoken to Ollie over the last maybe four seasons. I'd have a good relationship with him. I would have before that. And I said, you know what? He's a passionate man. He's an absolute gentleman. So I thought, can I help him? You know, can I help him going forward? Obviously, he had spoken to me that it was a very, very young squad. There was a couple of older lads like Keith Cowan, Garrett Harkin, Jacob Borg that were in the squad. But, you know, I would have been the only one that would have had real, real Premier Division experience, you know, over the last couple of seasons. So I said, you know what, I'm going to give this guy, you know, my time, you know, and I'm going to do everything I have in my power to help us, you know, do something. And he's been absolutely I can't give the man the credit he deserves, because you have to know him, you have to be dealing with the man every single day to realize what type of a person he is. Passionate, oh Jesus, he just oozes it, you know. But as a human being, as a person, he's unbelievable. He couldn't do enough for you. He couldn't, you know. I'm just going now by last Thursday night. Obviously, I'd stay up the night before a game. We were due to play Waterford on a Friday. My son was sick all week with a bug. I've trained on the Thursday night. I'm in the hotel. I wake up at 1-2 o'clock in the morning, feeling like I've just been hit by a bus, just terrible.
Mateo's fault, obviously.
Pretty much, just absolutely dying, stomach cramps, going to the toilet, getting sick, just awful. Woke up the next day, you know, that was all night, whatever. Next day, then I'm even worse. The Friday, we're due to play Waterford, and I'm like, right, I have to text Ollie. So text Ollie. He couldn't do enough. He's teaching now. He's in the middle of it. I can hear the students in the background. And he's here talking to me on the phone. Look, what can we do? Can I get you to the doctor? So I'll get someone to come and pick you up. They'll bring you to the hospital or bring you to the doctor in Lifford. And we'll try and get you sorted for tonight. So I'm thinking, right, we'll do that. But I've went to the doctor anyways, he's got me to the doctor. I drove myself, obviously, because I didn't want Ollie trying to get him. But he couldn't do enough. Like, he was going to leave the college himself, come down and pick me up and bring me to the doctor. That's what type of person he is. But anyways, the doctor said, no, look, you're out, you're not fit. Obviously, the bigger picture is you go into the dressing room, you're going to pass it around. The whole squad then come Monday, Friday. You don't have a team to bloody play. So that was the bigger picture, and I ended up missing the Monday game because of the same thing as well. but feeling a lot better now. And that's what I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to paint a picture that the type of man, he couldn't do enough. Like he had gotten someone to drive my car from Ballybuffet back to Tubbercurry on the Friday, if I wanted. Now I drove. It took me 2.5 hours.
A couple of stops.
But I got there. But he was getting someone to do it for me. You know, that's the type of man he is. And a damn good manager as well. You know, obviously Hegsy up there, his assistant, another gentleman, and Willie. So, you know, I can't give the men enough credit. You know, he's been very good to me in terms of, he knew obviously I was coaching with the 19s at Sligo. And, you know, kind of knows that I want to go into the bit of coaching and in that. So Hegsy and Willie are doing their pro license at the minute. And, you know, any time that they're away doing their pro license, Ollie will get in contact with me and ask me to take parts of the session that they're not there. So, you know, I'm really grateful for him for putting his trust in me to take parts of the session, you know, leading up to a game, you know. Obviously, I don't know if any of the other lads have licenses in the squad, but, you know, he's obviously says there, you know, he's given me the ownership of it. Look, this is what you wanted to do. I'll set it up and we do it. And, you know, I've really enjoyed it.
But you have an A license.
Yeah.
So you're only one step away from that pro opportunity yourself.
Pretty much, yeah.
We're going to come back, just touch on the coaching before we finish up. But this season, Finn Harps, it's looked worse on paper than it possibly was in the dressing room or even on the pitch. Because I've seen some of your games, and you've been very unlucky in games, conceding last-minute penalties, last-minute goals, denying yourself wins, really, rather than probably the wins you deserved or the draws turned into defeats. Like there was a 4-3 against Cork, you were bitterly unlucky to lose a game. The game Sligo Rovers played up there, you could have taken a point or more out of that. You should have taken probably the win in the Showgrounds, last minute penalty again, Ronan Coughlin buries it. How satisfying was it to get not just one but two wins in close succession in the last few weeks and get off the bottom of the table?
It was unbelievable. You know, we had a massive week there where we had gotten a point away to Sligo, possibly should have won it, like you said, definitely should have won the game, you know, a late penalty. We went down to Cork and we got a draw, and then we were at home to UCD and got a big win, a 3-0 win. We carried that, we had a break then for a week, obviously, which we thought came at a bad time because we were hitting a bit of form, but we carried that then on to go and beat Waterford. We always knew that Shamrock Rovers on the Monday was a big ask, as it is no matter, you know, any time they're in town. They're a fantastic side, probably the best side I've seen this year, bar Dundalk. But you know, we're away now to Derry on Friday, and you know, we're hoping to bring that momentum into that game. And I think the big thing was however all the lads stuck together, everyone stuck together, and we knew that we were playing well, that we weren't just getting the rub of the green, you know, the little decisions going our way. And that has now turned around. We're now getting little decisions going our way because we've worked so hard to get to where we are. And like I said, we just need to keep that consistency, that belief among the group now going forward into the remainder of the season and climb the table.
Do you think, obviously you've passed UCD, I think, on goal difference, maybe they might have, I'm not exactly sure what it looks like.
Yeah, goal difference.
But
yeah,
the two of you are there or thereabouts on 10 points, and there's a small group about 10 points ahead of you, Waterford, Sligo, Cork. Can you catch one of them?
I think we can, yeah. Absolutely. I think that's what we have to think in our heads. You've got to look at Sligo, who we've played twice, and
like, genuinely,
there's
very
nothing between
unlucky.
Us. Yeah.
You beat them in the League Cup, and you should have probably beaten them in the Showgrounds, and could have maybe snatched something in the first game. So, arguably, you could be the better off in that situation where they've ended up with 4 points.
Yeah.
It could have been you very easily.
Absolutely. So we know that there's not an awful lot between us and them. Waterford, we do know what, look, Waterford are hot and cold. Waterford went to Richmond Park before they came to us and beat Pats 3-0. Not many is going to go to Richmond and win 3-0. So they're hot and cold. And we know Waterford can, you can get the Waterford that'll turn up, that'll beat you 3-4-0, which they did down in the RSC, us. To where we beat them 3-2 in Finn Park. But absolutely, we have to be looking up that table. We got to be looking up instead of looking down. You know, like I said, there's a belief among the group. And the big thing is everyone is stuck together. And if you do that and keep that belief, there's only one way you're going to go. You're going to go up. And we have a little thing there now where we can, you know, we can see Sligo. That's our next aim now. Can we catch them? You know, that's what it has to be.
You mentioned the fact that the coaching. So let's kind of finish up on this topic, because obviously you're 38. The legs probably don't quite have what they had when you were 25. I think it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. Starting last season, you were involved with the under-19s in Sligo Rovers. And if you look at that squad that you had of 20 players, you had John Mahan, Jack Keeney, Ed McGinty, Luke McNicholas, Liam Kerrigan, Niall Moran, Darren Collins, and possibly even one or two more, Scott Lynch, who have all been in and around the first team this year and last year. How much pride do you take out of having had even the smallest... Because I know the likes of Jack Mahan or Jack Keeney and John Mahan would have been very early moved on to the first team. How much pride do you take in watching them? Because I know you captained Finn Harps against most of those players a couple of weeks ago. Was that a surreal experience for you?
Yeah, it's funny. Like, you know, obviously you're there in with the 19s. Obviously they've come up from the 17s. Young lads just turning 17, 18. You know, and to see them now, 2 years on, established first team players in such the air. That's what the air, like John Mahan is, Jack Keeney anyways, Liam Kerrigan, Niall Moran. You know, Niall Moran probably has been the biggest surprise, I think, for everyone at Sligo this year.
People who didn't know.
But that's my next thing.
Like, I think the host would have been fully aware of what he was 100%.
Yeah. Niall is the kind of lad, he'll come in, go about his business, doesn't, you know, put up a big hurrah, not very loud, but does all his talking on the pitch, has a fantastic attitude, is a great lad, and is going to do well. Is going to do very well because he's got that attitude.
Yeah, I'm not surprised he's in that Irish setup.
Absolutely. 100%, because he does the stuff that only you know as a coach or a teammate. He does that work that people don't see, that say possibly Danny Ventry used to do for us, you know, the dirty work. The tidying up, the balls going into the striker where he's intercepting them and stuff like that. The stuff you don't see. He's a very intelligent player, Niall Moran. Did they play him right back a couple of times? Do I think right back is his best position? Me, personally, I don't think it is. I think the six is his natural habitat. But is that part of his development, playing at right back? Definitely. Because he's going to learn more at right back, playing against better players, how to stop them. You know, it's obviously part of his development. So I think that's a big thing Liam Buckley probably looked at. He needed maybe a little bit of work defensively, and he stuck him at right back, and that's probably helped develop him. But definitely six is his position, I think. Six or an eight. But yeah, look, going back to seeing these lads in playing regularly and doing fantastic is great. You know, like all the underage coaches, you know, you're going back to the 17s, to where they came into the group, the 17s, obviously, Danny and Jinxie, they all have a hand in their development, you know. When they came into the first team, did I try and help them? Absolutely. Did I try and say little things that would help them? 100%. You know, anything that can help them, and still, even you know, if and I'm not boasting about it, or I'm not saying anything about it, you know, I still get 19s players, former 19s players that are playing in our league, in our first division and Premier Division, that will contact me and ask me something and what I think about something and how can I'll tell them exactly, you know. I'm just going to use them as an example. When we beat UCD 3-0, I had Paul Doyle on the phone to me the next day, you know, saying that, you know, he feels he can give more, he's not getting the best out of himself as a player. You know, I feel I have an obligation, you know, as a former coach, and because I like the kid and I think he's got fantastic potential, I'm going to offer anything I can do to help the kid, you know, be a better player that might help him develop into a fantastic player, you know. Obviously, he's finding the jump from First Division to the Premier Division, you know, mentally it's tough, physically it's tough. But they're all learning curves, and I'm telling them that he'll learn more this year playing in this division than he will playing for 10 seasons in the First Division, you know. And that's what it's all about. And as a senior player, if any young lads come and ask me, I'll try my best to give them the best possible information, positive information, that will help them going forward in their careers.
You turn 38 this year. I can't finish the interview without asking, is this your last season playing League of Ireland football? Is there another season in the legs? What's the next steps?
I think I have it in my head that this is most likely going to be the last season. I think, yeah, there's not for any reason that I feel that the legs are going. Yeah, of course I'm not going to cover the same ground I covered 6-10 years ago. That's, you know, what goes without saying. But as you get older, you have it more in the head where you can read a game a lot better, so you don't have to be running around the pitch tackling lads, mental stuff like that. You can read a game a lot better, so you're not obviously doing as much as the work as you would have when you were 26, like you said, running around like a lunatic tackling the referee even as such. But
I see you were tackling the referee.
Yeah. But
Jack Russell got it.
I'm definitely, you know, I've a few bits and pieces in the pipeline, you know, coming up. I'm working on something that I'm hoping will be good. Do I see myself working in some capacity somewhere? Look, I'm no one to say that, you know, unless a manager says to me he wants me in helping him or working with him, that's where that's at. But I'm going to continue to develop myself as a coach. You know, I don't hide the fact that one day, yeah, I want to manage a team, I suppose. You know, I think if you're not that ambitious, is there any point kind of doing it? Do I want to develop young players? Absolutely. I enjoyed the 4 or 5 years I was with the 19s. Would have loved to have stayed on helping, but again, out of my control. But look, God knows what the future holds, but I definitely think it's going to be good, and I'm looking forward to it.
And possibly off the pitch.
Possibly off the pitch, yeah. Okay. Definitely.
Well, definitely. Is that a definitely or a possibly definitely?
Possibly definitely.
Listen, Raf, it's been an absolute pleasure sitting with you for the last hour or so. The very best of luck tomorrow night in your game, and also for the rest of the season. I hope Finn Harps do manage to avoid relegation, which I think... I think you might actually do really, really well for the rest of the season. I think things are starting to come together for you. So the very best of luck. It's been lovely to kind of just drag up all these old happy memories of the last 20-odd years in the sport. And I'd like to wish you the very, very best of luck.
Go Gentlemen, forward. Thanks for having me.
For anyone listening who wants to hear more of similar interviews with Raf's cousin, Carlo, and his better half, Florence, and many, many others, including other sports luminaries as John Leonard, who was sober Paddy, who overcame drug abuse to win an All-Ireland medal with Dublin, and plenty of other sports heroes and other interesting and inspirational and motivational people on the podcast. You can subscribe on iTunes. You can also check it out on brefneyearly.com/podcast for all the back episodes. We're going to be back into a weekly schedule. It's been a long minute since we posted interviews, but we're going to have them coming back on a weekly basis going forward. If there's anyone you'd like to hear, let me know on Twitter or Instagram. It's @BrefneyEarly, who you think inspires you, motivates you, and I will do my best to sit down and have a chat with those people as we go forward with the series. Thank you very much for tuning in. It's been a bit of a long one, but I think you'll find it's been absolutely worth it. Raf, an absolute legend. Thank you very much.
Thank you.